on Westwood One.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Absolute Broadcasting, its staff, or advertisers.
It's time for Israel is Real. Two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel. Rahel and Sonia focus on life in modern 21st century Israel, telling the stories of ordinary people living in, loving, and in support of an extraordinary land. Israel is Real is a community-supported program featuring interviews with local, national, and international celebrities, personal life stories, and call-ins. Learn a new Hebrew word every week. Israel is Real. Every Friday on 1590 WSMN, Nashua's News and Talk. And now, your hosts, Rahel and Sonia.
Hello, good morning. We're Rahel and
Sonia.
And this is Israel is Real. Boker tov lekol ha-mazinim.
Tzoraim tovim b'Yisrael.
From WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk. We are a community-supported program, and that means we depend on your support to stay on the air. And we always like to extend our thanks to all those who love and support our efforts on behalf of spreading the good news about Israel. We've got some wonderful sponsors, some wonderful helpers, and keep those donations coming. We are trying to reach goals of staying on for another year. So so if you like what we're doing, please visit our website at www.israelisreal.weebly.com. That's israelisreal.weebly.com. And you can email us at israelisreal1590@gmail.com. That's israelisreal1590@gmail.com. Some of our sponsors include Vision.
Vision. Rachel, did you know that Vision is an organization that educates our community about the little country of Israel?
I did.
Did you know who said this? And I quote, "Who can challenge the rights of the Jews in Palestine? Good Lord, historically, it is really your country." You don't know.
No, I don't know.
It's Youssef Daya al-Khalidi, which was the mayor of Jerusalem in 1899. To receive Vision's emails alert and be informed about Vision's educational activities and opportunities, please visit Vision website at www.newhampshireforisrael.org. That's www.nh4israel.org.
And one of our wonderful sponsors and a very loyal man is Vern Main. The patent and trademark law firm of Vern Main and Associates, a local firm with a global practice, is pleased to announce its new office location at 547 Amherst Street. That's 547 Amherst Street in Nashua. You can find them on the web also at www.vernmain.com, vernmaine.com, for professional legal counseling on all intellectual property matters. Contact the legal specialists at Vern Main and Associates, again at their offices at 547 Amherst Street in Nashua, or on the web at vernmaine.com, vernmaine.com.
Rachel, music ad. Drawing on the wisdom of ancient mystical and spiritual traditions, Rachel performs an intriguing guitar and vocal mix of folk, world, traditional, and transformational music to create an atmosphere of calm and joy. Rachel Music is suitable for all ages, occasions, and venues. Please contact Rachel at www.rachelmusic.net, means www.rahelmusic.net.
I like that person.
Uh-huh. You should know her.
Great music.
Great person.
And great sponsors.
Right.
So, Sonia, as we are like to do, we'd like to introduce our listeners to a new Hebrew word this week, which is
Balshanut.
Balshanut.
And do you know what's the meaning of Balshanut?
I do.
Nice.
It's a very good word.
Well, Balshanut, it's rooted in the three letters, Bet, Lamed, Shin, which are balash, actually, in Hebrew.
Hashasha balash.
Exactly, and means a detective. So Balshanut should have something to do with the work of a detective, with something. But we can look to the Balshanut and from the other aspect. Balshanut is like Belashon or Bilashon, which literary work with, it's something that somebody which is working with the language. So our detective is looking after the meaning of words or the roots of the words.
Mm.
In this case, Balshanut means philology or linguistics. And
I like that word, philology.
Yeah.
It's a new word I just recently learned in English.
No, I knew it a long time ago.
But today we are talking about Lashon and Balshanut.
And Balshan.
Because we have a really, really interesting guest and really splendid scholar named Dr. Joel Hoffman. Dr. Joel Hoffman is an expert in translation, in Hebrew, and in the Bible. He's a much sought-after speaker who presents to dozens of popular and academic audiences every year. He holds a PhD in linguistics, philology, no, in linguistics, and has served on our faculties of Brandeis University and also Hebrew Union College. Now, Dr. Hoffman's latest work, if you can see it there in the webcam if you're looking, is And God Said, How Translations Conceal the Bible's Original Meaning, put out by Thomas Dune Books, St. Martin's Press, in which he explores how translation mistakes mask the original meaning of the Bible. And it offers detailed new insight into the Ten Commandments, Psalm 23, the Song of Songs, the virgin birth of Isaiah 7, verse 14, and much more. So we're really eager to talk to Dr. Hoffman. We've had a few conversations with him, and surprisingly, we found out that we only have actually two questions after all of that. And Boker Tov, Dr. Hoffman.
Oh, good morning. What a treat to be with you this morning.
It's a special treat for us, and I hope our listeners are really going to love this conversation with you. How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Let me tell you, I do hear background music on my end of the phone. I'm calling in from New York. I'm wondering if your listeners hear the background music, too.
Yeah, they're hearing a little bit. We're going to turn that down so we can talk to you a little bit more clear. And I've been at your lectures, and I've heard you talk and seen you talk, and I really enjoyed your lectures, and I thought, this is a man we want to bring to our show. So we've said a little bit about yourself. You're a scholar and a PhD. Let's start with our first question. How does one research ancient Hebrew in order to understand the true meaning of the text?
Well, what a great question. How does one figure out what the ancient Hebrew means? Let me start with a little bit of background. We're going to be talking mostly about Hebrew this morning, obviously. Almost everything I have to say applies to ancient Greek as well, and for that matter, to ancient Aramaic. The Bible was originally written in Hebrew and in Aramaic, and that's what some people call the Bible, some people call the Tanakh, and some people call the Old Testament. The people who call that the Old Testament refer to something called the New Testament, which was largely written in Greek. We're going to be talking about Hebrew, but almost everything applies to all of those languages, and in fact to more, because that's sort of the point. One of the most interesting discoveries last century as part of the modern field of linguistics was that most languages, and all languages rather, share certain elements and have certain elements in common. So the way we figure out what the ancient Hebrew meant is by looking at it as a language. And the way we do that is by looking at what we know about languages. So essentially what we do is we look at different ways of investigating language and see which ones work and which ones don't.
Sort of really that Balshanut, that detective work.
That Balshanut, and actually I'm going to come back to the word Balshan and Balshanut as an example in a little while.
We're having a really lot of noise outside. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, okay, are we good?
Yes, we're good.
Excellent. So essentially it's a twofold process to figure out what the ancient Hebrew means. The first step is figuring out how we figure it out, and then the second step is actually figuring it out. I thought maybe we'd give listeners just sort of a sample of how wrong things can go, as it were. So there's a phrase from Song of Songs, which is widely used at weddings, for example. Song of Songs is about romantic love. That's why it's often recited or sung at weddings. And there's a very famous line, Libavtini achoti chala, you have ravished my heart, my sister, my bride. Many of your listeners probably walked down the aisle to it or had children who walked down the aisle or parents who walked down the aisle, though they probably don't remember it. It's a very common line, Libavtini achoti chala, you've ravished my heart, my sister, my bride. Here's the thing, though. Not only is my sister, my bride, not romantic in English, that's illegal in this country. And so, so the question we have to ask is, how is it that translations, in this case, turned courtship into a felony? And that's sort of the magnitude of the problem. So that sort of sets the stage.
Okay.
I would also start with an anecdote as well. Sherlock Holmes and his sidekick Watson decide to go camping. British sleuth Sherlock Holmes. And they go camping, and because they're British, they put on their dinner jackets before they sit down to dinner, because that's what British. I don't know how many listeners are British. They can confirm this or deny it.
Maybe at least one or two,
as they like. And this is, by the way, part of the answer, just in case your listeners think that somehow they accidentally changed the station. So they go camping and they have a fine meal. That's actually not true, because they're British. They have a British meal, They retire to their tent and they fall asleep, and that's the point. And Sherlock Holmes wakes up in the middle of the night and says to his sidekick, Watson, he says, Watson, look at all those stars. What do you think that means? And of course, Watson is half asleep and it's the middle of the night and he's barely coherent, but he wants to impress his mentor, so he tries to think of something. He says, means? He says, well, I guess astronomically, he says, I guess it means that we live in an ever-expanding universe, he says. And Holmes is not impressed. He says, well, I guess, he says, theologically, he says, I guess it means that we are the tiniest nothing of nothing in God's great expanse. And Holmes still isn't expressed. And he tries a few more things, and none of them work. And finally, exasperated, he says, why, Holmes? What does it mean to you? And Holmes says, Watson, you're a moron. It means someone has stolen our tent.
Oh, that's wonderful. And Dr. Hoffman, Joel, we have to cut out for a short break. And on that note, it's a good place to stop for a moment. So we will be back. This is Nashua's News and Talk, WSMN 1590. And this is Israel is Real. We'll be back with Dr. Joel Hoffman in just a moment.
לפועל ולתואר ולשם ובחצות הששית בחלונות היה רושם במילונות אילי תילים מילים יפות, מילים אפות מתגלגלות מן הלשון אליעזר, מתי תשכב לישון אין קומתך כמעט אפיים שחר והעברית אשר חיכתה אלפיים היא תמתין לך עד בוא השחר
1590 WSMN
and WSMNradio.com
The Telegraph, keeping you connected to your community for pennies a day.
When news breaks,
The Telegraph is there. When the community needs a watchdog, The Telegraph is there. When it's time to celebrate the accomplishments of our young athletes and scholars,
The Telegraph is there.
All for pennies a day. The Telegraph has been recognized for 7 years in a row as the best small daily newspaper in New England by the New England Press Association. Find out why one of New England's best daily newspapers is your daily newspaper for only pennies a day.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Rattlesnake at the Pond.
Oh, Johnny, skipping rocks at the pond sure is fun.
Hey, look, a moving stick.
That ain't a stick. That's a rattlesnake.
Sassy, we're in danger.
Good idea, Sassy. Go get Mr. Gunderson.
You will in a second, but first you'd like to tell us something we may not know about animal shelters in the United States?
It's getting close, Sassy.
Approximately 8 million pets enter shelters each year?
The
the majority of which are in shelters because of owner-related issues that the animals have no control over?
Sassy the rattlesnake! Save us, Sassy!
What, Sassy? You wish you were videotaping this? Sassy!
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
8-year-old Beau Vernet of Londonderry, New Hampshire, is a player in the Northern Cyclones hockey organization. This past October, Beau and his sisters tragically lost both of their parents. Now, a fund has been set up to help the family with the expenses of raising the four Vernet children. Donations may be mailed directly to Vernet Family Children's Fund, P.O. Box 541073, Waltham, Massachusetts, 02454. That address again, Vernet Family Children's Fund, P.O. Box 541073, Waltham, Massachusetts, 02454. Please help if you can.
We're locally owned, and that means we're here to serve you. Nashua's News and Talk, 1590 WSMN.
Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Ahad. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Had. اعلم يا إسرائيل أن الله ربنا الله الوحيد وأهبت إذ أذناي
ألاقى. We're back on WSMN 1590 Nashua's News and Talk with Israel is Real. We are two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel, and we're speaking today with a wonderful man, Dr. Joel Hoffman, and his book is And God Said, andgodsaid.com, if you're looking for it. Dr. Hoffman.
Good to be back.
Yes.
We sort of left the listeners on a cliffhanger,
right,
with a break there. I just told an anecdote about Sherlock Holmes and Watson. I didn't get a chance to get to the point, so people who are still around get to hear the point.
Oh, good.
And the point is that there are different ways for something to mean something, and what something means depends upon what you're trying to do. And I think that's particularly important when it comes to talking about the Bible, because, as you know, everyone and his cousin has an idea of what the Bible means. And I don't want to say that they're wrong. What I do want to say is that there are different ways of looking at what something means. And what I do is I figure out what it originally meant when it was written down. So when I ask the question, what does the ancient Hebrew of the Bible, or as I said, the ancient Greek of the Bible, mean? My question is, what did it mean when they were writing it down? And in particular, how do we figure out what it meant? And the answer to that comes in terms of three false starts and then one final answer. There are three commonly used ways of figuring out what the Bible meant, and they've been used actually for about the past 400 years at least, and they don't work. But because they're so widespread, because people use them so often, it's worth looking at those three wrong ways and figuring out why they don't work, so that we can figure out what actually does work. So I'm going to go through the three wrong ways. I'm going to give some examples from modern languages. You'll remember that essentially all languages are the same, so we can look at modern languages to see if a way is actually productive, to see if a way of looking at language actually works. It's worth reminding your listeners that modern Hebrew is different than biblical Hebrew. It might seem you could just ask, you know, one of you guys, and you could ask a modern Hebrew speaker what the ancient Hebrew means, and it doesn't work that way because Hebrew has changed. So we have to figure out how to look at the ancient Hebrew. And the first false start, the first wrong way, is etymology. Etymology is an enormous amount of fun, and perhaps because it's so much fun, people have been tempted to think that etymology tells us what a word means. Unfortunately, it does not, and as I said, we can look at modern examples.
You've just discounted me as a Hebrew teacher and also the whole linguistic field, right? Or
well,
not.
Well, then I guess my work here is done. Well, see, that's the whole point. I haven't discounted the whole linguistic field.
Okay.
And etymology is fun, and it's useful, and it's enjoyable. It just doesn't tell us what a word actually means, at least not according to what people originally intended. And, you know, we can go through some examples in English. My favorite example, simple example, is glamour and grammar. It turns out that glamour and grammar share an etymology, so it asked people to think back to eighth grade and symbolically raise their hands if they remember grammar as being particularly glamorous. Normally, you know, I do travel around the country giving lectures, and I'm frequently the only one in the room who raises my hand yes for that recollection. You know, another example comes from what you started off with, which is Balshan. Balshan, which you know, does have the word balash, which is detective, and has lashon, which is language, and Balshan means linguist in modern Hebrew. I don't know how many people know that it is actually a word that comes from the Bible. The word appears in Nehemiah, and it's one of a list of names, and they list the names. They list Mordechai and then a guy named Bilshan, and that's Bilshan's the second guy. So it's Mordechai, Bilshan, and then Zerubbabel's in the list, I think. Some other people whose names I don't remember right. Mispar, I think, is in the list. That's not true. I don't remember who's in the list. At any rate, we have Mordechai and Bilshan, and then the Talmud, which is the first millennium C of the Common Era, points out, well, Mordechai Bilshan sounds like Mordechai Baal Lashon.
Mm-hmm.
And Baal Lashon means master of language. So they say this must mean that Mordechai was a master of language. And this is where the connection comes from, and it's sort of an etymological source. And it's interesting, I think, and it did give us a modern Hebrew word. So the modern Hebrew word Balshan comes from this, you know, sort of fanciful interpretation from at least 1,500 years ago. But that doesn't mean that that's what Balshan meant when it was written in Nehemiah. The exact list appears in Ezra as well, if I remember correctly. So we see sort of two divergent paths. One is this interesting meandering through the history of the language, and the other is trying to figure out what were they trying to do in Ezra and Nehemiah when they wrote this stuff down. And the answer is not always the same. So that's sort of the point of etymology, that etymology tells you what a word used to mean or how a word came into the language, but it doesn't tell us what the word meant way back when, which doesn't mean it's not interesting.
Right.
Ironically, the word etymology comes from the Greek for true meaning. It's actually not the true meaning, but, you know, sort of that's the point. So that's the first false start is etymology. The second false start is related, and that's internal structure. Now, Hebrew, as you know, has a very rich internal structure, and it's a lot of fun to study for the sort of people who find that thing fun. You know, we have something called a binyan in Hebrew, which I'll translate. It's a verbal paradigm, which, of course, is not at all a useful translation. There's a lot of internal structure in Hebrew, and because it's so rich, people tend to look at the internal structure to try to figure out what words mean. And once again, it doesn't work, and we can look at modern languages to see what goes wrong. For example, we have in English a word, host.
Host
is someone who has a radio show, for example, or who welcomes you, or who is kind, or who seats you at a restaurant, and so on. On the pattern of infantile, what would you think hostile means?
Oh, interesting.
You would think that hostile means something like a host, because infantile is like an infant. Or you would think that a host is someone who's hostile, and if that's true, you've been going to the wrong parties. So we see that internal word structure doesn't tell you what words mean.
Right.
Another great example comes from the English word patent. Patent, by definition, is a non-obvious invention. The lawyers call it a non-obvious art. You're not allowed to patent something that's obvious. You can't patent, at least in this country, you're not allowed to patent crossing the street, for example. So this thing in America, I'm going to guess someone's tried, right? They woke up and said, we've got a get-rich-quick scheme. We're going to patent crossing the street. In this country, you're not allowed to do it because a patent has to be non-obvious. How surprising, then, that patently means obviously. In other words, even something so simple as adding ly to a word doesn't tell you what the word means. Internal structure doesn't tell you what the words mean. And the same applies to every language, including Biblical Hebrew. The internal structure does not tell you what the words mean.
Okay.
This actually applies to phrases as well, and this is maybe one of the biggest misunderstandings in the Bible. Even once you know what the words mean, stringing them together to create phrases doesn't always tell you what the phrases mean. So again, we can look at English, and in English we have a verb pick, which means to open surreptitiously, like to pick a lock. And we have a word up, which means away from gravity, and we have a word on, which means in the direction of up and touching. This information does not tell you that pick up means to increase, like pick up the tempo, that pick on means to annoy, and that pick up on means to discern. So we see that the structure doesn't tell you the meaning. Another great example, of course, is the drive-through window.
Right. And it took a second to get that one.
it said to drive through. I don't know. So our second false start, then, is internal structure. And we add that to etymology. The third false start is cognate languages. Words can mean different things in different languages, even if they're related. This is frequently called word borrowing, though obviously we don't give the words back. It's really word taking. So, again, we can look at modern languages for an example, and now we have to look at more than one language so we can see the borrowing, and we look at English and French. Then-President of France, François Mitterrand, came to America, and through an interpreter said that the French president demands that the American president come visit France. Almost causing an international incident, obviously. And what happened is this. The French word demand actually means to ask. So right. demande means to ask, not to demand. And right. even though they are cognate words, they mean different things. Another really good example comes from the modern Hebrew. There's something called the autobus, which is pretty clearly a bus. Mm-hmm. And they have an autobus express, which it turns out is the local bus.
Right, right.
So, and even though it's taken from the English, and there's a story behind that we can go into another time, but there's a cognate language issue there. And, you know, you frequently see this in Bible translations. You'll see, like, the word nefesh, which is wrongly translated as soul, as in b'chol nafshecha. And then you'll see a footnote, something like, you know, compare the Akkadian, and it will list the Akkadian. Well, first of all, I don't know who that footnote is written for.
Uh-huh.
I don't imagine there are a lot of people reading the Bible who don't know any Hebrew and don't know what nefesh means, but fortunately they happen to have studied Akkadian. But even if we did know, even if there was someone like that, and even if we did know what the Akkadian word meant, which we don't, it still wouldn't tell us what the Hebrew word means.
Right.
So we have etymology, internal structure, and cognate languages, and these are the three false starts that do not tell us what the ancient languages mean. Unfortunately, these are the methods that have been used to create almost every Bible translation available. So when you look at a Bible translation, you're looking at a translation that is as flawed as thinking that passently means like a pageant, or the thinking that a host is hostile, or thinking that grammar is glamorous. That's how bad the translations are because of these three false starts.
So many things are coming to my head. I'm thinking about the Tower of Babel. Did God do this on purpose just, you know, to... you know, so that we wouldn't understand, and will there ever be peace anywhere?
I hope those are rhetorical questions.
Yes. I wouldn't expect you to answer them today.
I hope you're not asking me what is God's plan for the world and will be peace, because I don't really think we have enough time, even if I had an inkling as to the answer.
Right, right. But we are asking you again from your book, AndGodSaid.com, and God said, what is going on here?
So what is going on? We looked at the three false starts, the three wrong ways to figure out what language means. Fortunately, that's not the end. Fortunately, there is a way to figure out what the ancient words mean. And the way we do that is by looking at the words in their context. Almost by definition, a word's meaning is how it appears in context. And again, we can look at some examples from modern languages. So in English in America, we have business letters, and business letters are normally signed sincerely. Now, in the context of a business letter, the word sincerely really just means my name comes next. It does not imply any particular degree of sincerity. And the way we know that is right. You can imagine writing a letter to the Internal Revenue Service. Let's suppose you are trying to explain why the $85,000 sports car that you just bought your 16-year-old daughter for her birthday really is a legitimate business expense.
Uh-huh.
But you fill the page with four paragraphs of lies, and how do you sign that letter? You sign it sincerely. This does not imply any particular degree of sincerity. By the same token, right. In Israel, letters are signed b'chavod, which literally means with honor, but this doesn't mean that Israeli letters are particularly honorful or have any higher degree of honor than American letters do of sincerity, for example. So we see that you have to look at how the words are used in their context to figure out what the words actually mean.
Right.
So we can now go right back to the beginning when I talked about my sister, my bride, Libavtini Achoti Chala. Fortunately, it doesn't mean incest, which is, of course, the good news. And we can look at how the words brother and sister and other kinship terms are used in their context to figure out what's going on.
Okay.
In this, I'm sorry?
Okay.
Yeah, so in this case, we're lucky to have some guidance in terms of other ancient documents. We have surviving letters from various kings. And the kings address each other as, to my father the king, to my brother the king, or to my son the king. And there's even a surviving document that says, to my son the king, how dare you address me as my brother the king. And what's going on is this. They're using kinship terms like brother and father and son, not just for family relations, but also for power structure. Mm-hmm. And so a more powerful king is called my father the king, an equipotent king is called my brother the king, and a less powerful king is called my son the king. And that's why the guy says, to my son the king, how dare you call me my brother the king? In other words, who do you think you are?
Right, right.
So this guides us where to look for ach and achot, brother and sister, in the Bible. And we find that in the Bible, the words are also used for power structure. Prophets will sometimes call a king my father the king, just to make it clear that they understand the king is in charge. Frequently, they'll follow it up by saying, you know, you're doing it all wrong, because that's what prophets did. But we see that these are used for power structure, and in particular in Song of Songs, which is about romantic love, we find that the words are used for power structure. Song of Songs, after all, is the Bible's only full-length treatise on relationships, and it hits the reader over the head with the importance of the man and the woman being not brother and sister, obviously, but rather in this case being equals.
Uh-huh.
The point is, achoti chala is the woman who is my equal. And that's what's so important in the Bible. So we find that a better look at how to figure out what the words mean, looking at context, points us in the direction of what I think is actually a much nicer message for a wedding, the notion that as a couple enters into a lifelong relationship, the power structure must be one of equality. And we get that from looking at context. So I would translate it not as my sister, but rather as perhaps my partner or my equal.
Wow, this is fascinating, Dr. Hoffman. We've got 2 minutes till the break. I'm just giving you a little warning there. But you can continue for another minute or so.
Okay, well, why don't we, in that case, at least raise the issue of Adonai Ro'i, the Lord is my shepherd.
Okay.
And see where we can go with that.
This is Psalm...
Psalm 23. It's very commonly recited or sung at funerals. It's one of the most well-known passages of the Bible. It's hard for me to imagine that there's a religious community in the Judeo-Christian world that doesn't use Psalm 23 in some context. The Lord is my shepherd. If you look at the word carefully, though, you find that even though the word ro'ed literally means shepherd, it's a mistranslation. It doesn't convey any of the original imagery of what an original ro'eh was. So as we come up to the break, I would ask people to think about sort of what actor would you cast as a shepherd if you were thinking of modern actors. You know, imagine a shepherd in your mind. What does a shepherd look like? And so when I do this, I think to myself, you know, he's probably weighs about 90 pounds. He's got a crooked staff, which apparently is even called a crook. he's sort of hunched over, probably not a people person. It seems to me. You know, a shepherd is sort of a loner, marginalized, weakling, better with sheep than with people.
Yeah.
Things like that. I would say, you know, if you write under previous occupation, if you're applying for a job, if you write shepherd, you can probably save yourself the stamp and not send the application in. You're not going to get the job.
And in my mind is coming up Charlton Heston.
Everyone thinks of Charlton Heston, of course, because Charlton Heston did that great movie. I'll tell you, I would think of Woody Allen to play Shepard. a schlub. As we're going to see, though, it turns out that John Wayne is actually a better choice.
Woody Allen, it's too talkative.
I'm sorry?
Woody Allen, it's too talkative.
Too talkative? Well, I didn't mean the talkative part of Woody Allen. I forgot about that.
Okay.
I meant sort of the physical demeanor of Woody Allen, was what I was thinking of first. With no obvious, you know, no offense to Mr. Allen. It's, people in glass houses and so forth.
Right. Well, we're going to cut out to a break. We're talking with Dr. Joel Hoffman about his book called And God Said, which is available at andgodzed.com. We are WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk. This is Israel is Real, and we'll be back in just a minute.
WSMN
and WSMNradio.com.
Hi, this is Danny Aiello. You're listening to Crosswinds with Carl Zahn.
Tune in to Crosswinds, hosted by Carl Zahn, Sundays at 11 a.m. on 1590 WSMN, Nashua's News and Talk. Carl is a stand-up comedian, website columnist, and radio veteran who provides a platform for all residents and issues concerning Southern New Hampshire. Listen to his interviews with renowned actors, authors, comedians, activists, and politicians. Call in with your observations or thoughts at 816-1590. It's Crosswinds with Carl Zahn, Sundays at 11 a.m. on 1590 WSMN, Nashua's News and Talk.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh boy, a kitty cat. Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Sassy? It's not a kitty, it's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters?
This bobcat's heavy. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean? Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Okay, kids, the campfire's out. Let's hit the road.
Dad, the fire's not out. It's still smoking.
No, close enough.
Come on, Dad, do your homework. If it's too hot to touch, then it's too hot to leave.
I knew that.
You're never too young to get your smoky on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Nashua was chosen the best place to live twice. If you're planning on living twice, do it with us. 1590 WSMN.
We're back on WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk with Israel is Real. We are two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel. And we're back talking with Dr. Joel Hoffman about his book, And God Said. If you're looking in the webcam, you can see the title there and the book. And that's andgodsaid.com. And Dr. Joel Hoffman, you were talking about the word ro'eh, shepherd.
Exactly. And, you know, we translated as shepherd already prejudicing the issue, and we left off with thinking of, you know, sort of what actor would represent shepherdness best. We can now jump directly to the text and look at how the word is used in context. And we see that shepherds in the Bible were brave, powerful, and even regal. Unlike shepherds today, you know, as I said, we think of shepherds, at least I think of a 90-pound weakling. I will tell you, I was, the initial book tour for And God Said was through Alabama. And there was a woman there from the Pacific Northwest, and she said that shepherds out there are, you know, are massive he-men. So I actually had never met someone who'd met a shepherd, so it was a new experience for me, so I am left to my imagination. But in the Bible, shepherds were very real, and in ancient life, in ancient Israel, shepherds were very real, and they were fierce, brave, and regal, as I say. So, for example, after Moses kills the taskmaster, Moses flees and ends up in the desert, and Jethro's kid and her friends are at the watering hole, and who comes to menace them? Who comes to harass them? The shepherds. Now, you know, when we think of it now, here come the shepherds. Well, we could probably take them, as it were. You know, it's not a big deal. But back then, it was a real threat. And Moses proved how brave he was and what a great leader he was to Jethro by defending the women even from the shepherds.
I never thought of that.
So it's a ridiculous image in modernity, but back then, it made perfect sense. For that matter, when a city is under siege in the Bible, who do you gather to marshal a defense, to round up to defend the city?
You're not going to tell me the shepherds.
The shepherds, that's right. So if your city is being attacked, what you do is you get all the shepherds together, and the shepherds are able to mount a defense. Once again, a laughable image in modernity, but that's how things work in antiquity.
Wow.
Because the shepherds were the mighty, fierce, brave, you know, warriors. For that matter, which biblical figure do we know who was a shepherd?
I'm thinking, I was going to go to Judah Maccabee, but...
No, turns out that King David, no less, was a shepherd. Now, I don't think you'd have a president today who was a shepherd. but even if you did, it wouldn't be a stepping stone. You wouldn't see a sign, you know, vote for Smith, a shepherd. so we see that even though the word shepherd captures the literal aspect of Roeh, it captures all of the wrong images and none of the right ones.
Wow.
So by comparison, we can again look at English, and we can look at the image of the sun. Now, Shakespeare writes, but soft what light through yonder window breaks, and it turns out that Juliet is the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here are two things I know about the sun in English. It will give you a sunburn, and it will give you skin cancer. I'm quite sure that Shakespeare didn't mean, hey, look, here's that girl that's going to give me skin cancer. Rather, what he meant was, here's that woman who is beautiful, because the sun functions metaphorically as an image of beauty, not of danger. In the Bible, it works both ways.
I think today you could say that she was hot.
Yeah, look who's writing Shakespeare, you know? So, exactly. In the Bible, the sun was a symbol of danger, and that's why we read, the sun will not harm me by day, nor the moon by night. So the point is not the actual sun, but rather what the sun represents. Another example comes from a psalm commonly sung on Friday evenings, which essentially ends, may you grow old and fat. Now, again, you know, you wouldn't put that on a Hallmark card in modern America, but the point in antiquity was that most people didn't get enough calories, and so they withered away into nothingness.
Uh-huh.
And back then, fat was the opposite of scrawny. So either you were scrawny and ill, or you were fat and healthy, whereas now fat has different metaphors and different images associated with it. So you ask, you know, is may you grow old and fat the right translation? I think the answer is no. You have to look not just at the literal meaning of the word, but also at how it's used in context and how it functions metaphorically. And the same thing is true of shepherd. Even though it is literally a shepherd, it does not mean someone who is scrawny and deals with sheep, not with people. What it means is a fierce, brave, mighty warrior, perhaps even with notions of kingness, and it's actually a fairly sexy guy in the Bible as well. So, you know, shepherd doesn't do it that way in modern America. So I don't think there's really a word that does. You know, fireman is sort of close. The Marines are sort of close. I was in a lecture, I think, in New Jersey, and someone suggested as a possibility, the Lord is my Rambo. Which, you know, it doesn't have that certain je ne sais quoi to it.
Right, right.
But all of those, the Lord is my hero. The essential point is that there's this mighty, fierce, brave, regal God that's got my back, and that's why I have nothing to worry about. It's not the modern image of a shepherd who's like this kind, calm, peaceful pastor. That was not the point at
uh-huh.
all. The point was, there's this mighty force guarding me, and therefore I don't have to worry about anything. And particularly in that context, when the psalm continues, and of course we don't have time to analyze the whole psalm, when when the psalm continues with still waters or quiet waters or peaceful waters or tranquil waters, it's this incredible image of contrast. You have this fierce, right, mighty force using the power not for not to stir things up, but rather to create tranquility. It's sort of like if you compare in your mind an image of a 95-year-old tiny grandmother holding a baby. That's nice.
Mm-hmm.
But I think more powerful is a 6'6", 250-pound fireman holding a baby. It's that image of contrast,
right,
that's so powerful that tugs at the heartstrings, and that's mm-hmm. what you have in Psalm 23. And unfortunately, all of that is lost through mistranslation. All of that is lost through translation that doesn't take advantage of modern scholarship and modern translation techniques and modern linguistics.
Well, what you're saying, I mean, you're changing my thought process, you know, and as a whole, but it seems that throughout the ages, you know, the original meaning through the language, through the translations, has really veiled, gone through many, many different layers, and we have to start uncovering all those layers and veils to really get to the essence.
I think that's exactly right. I would also say that throughout most of history, people didn't care about the original meaning. It wasn't so much that they didn't know, though of course they didn't know the original meaning, but they didn't really care about it. You know, we live in the era of modern science, and so we're interested in the scientific meaning. People were not always like that. In the Talmud, for example, which as I said is the beginning of the first millennium, first half of the first millennium, they didn't really care if they were looking at the original meaning. When they looked at Balshan and Bilshan and so on, they didn't care if that's what it originally meant. What they cared about is what can they make it mean. And that prevailed really until the scientific revolution, until modernity. And I actually think that while it's an interesting aspect of the Bible and it's an important one for us moderns, I think we should be careful not to overemphasize it. I think that there are still lots of valid ways of looking at what the Bible means. And I wouldn't want to suggest that, therefore, you can't use this familiar image at a funeral, for example. I think at a funeral of all times, when we're confronted with, you know, the power of life and the mystery and power of death, what the words originally meant is almost irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And what's really important is, you know, finding meaning with a, you know, with a capital M in our lives. And so I think these are going to end up existing side by side. I do think that it's important to be clear which one we're talking about. I think most people's frustration comes when translators or, for that matter, theologians or clergy are not clear whether they're doing sort of religious interpretation or whether they're doing scientific interpretation. And because of the confusion, a lot of people walk away thinking, rather than looking at good science and good religion, thinking that it's a bad mixture of both. So I think that's something to be avoided.
Well, you really have to look at what is your intention, and you know when you're speaking, and the power of words and all of that, and it's
sometimes also a question, a political question. What do you want to unveil from the text?
This is absolutely true. It's a political question. We for sure don't have enough time for an answer to this today, but at least raise the issue. Listeners may have heard two different translations of the Ten Commandments. One of them reads, "Thou shalt not kill," and the other one reads, "Thou shalt not murder." Well, those are obviously very, very
different
injunctions, the notion of killing versus murdering. I'll say neither one of those is completely accurate, though I do go through the whole story in my book, And God Said. But the answer to that is fairly widely known, and the choice comes down exactly what you say, to a political decision. Some people purposely translate it as "thou shalt not kill" in order to propagate their own notion of pacifism, even though they know that that's not what the Hebrew originally meant.
Exactly.
Interesting. We've got about another minute or two. Do you want to go out with a bang? Or how would you like to tie this up? And I just want to say that we are going to try and get you to try and get you to come out here to New Hampshire at some point to give a lecture, and we'd love to have you. And so, how would you like to tie up this discussion today?
Since you mentioned the lecture, I will mention that if listeners go to andgodsaid.com, they'll see a link to a blog, and they can see where I will be appearing. I have about a dozen appearances lined up for the fall, and I hope I'll meet some of them in person. And if I do, I hope that listeners will come up and introduce themselves to me when they hear me speak. And if you want to bring me to your community, you can find a link from there as well. I think the way to sum up is sort of by summarizing, which is that there are three wrong ways of looking at what the Hebrew means in one right way. And once we find the right way, we are actually brought much closer to a text. The text has been around for at least 2,500 years. And I think we live in a very, very exciting time. I think that thanks to the miracles of modern science and linguistics and translation theory, more than any other time, the ancient words are ours for the taking. And it's a treat and a joy to discover sort of long-hidden jewels that have been masked by mistranslation.
I think that, you know, Sonia and I are both Hebrew teachers, and I find the language just fascinating, and I've learned so much just from teaching Hebrew. And I'll let the listeners know that you do have a really interesting word that I'd love to hear about someday, and obviously not today, the word bitula, the virgin.
About the political.
Right. But,
yeah, you might have heard of a religion founded roughly on that principle.
Right, and I know you talk about that in your book, so we'll let the listeners find that out by buying your book on andgodsaid.com. Sonia, you wanted to... say something there?
After having Dr. Hoffman here, I would say maybe we should close our Hebrew word.
Yeah, we better have it checked first.
No, in this way, I cannot do it.
On the contrary.
Dr. Hoffman, it's been a real pleasure. We are really excited to have had you on the show today, and we will look forward to maybe possibly having you again, because you do have other subjects similar that we can talk about, so we'll look forward to that as too. So again, Dr. Hoffman, Dr. Joel Hoffman, can be found at andgodsaid.com. Please do buy his book. It's fascinating. Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
Shabbat shalom. It's a joy. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. And now, Parashat HaShavua.
I don't know, I'm afraid to even go there.
We'll try. A verse in Parashat Matot refers to the Israelite soldiers returning from war against the Midianites as those who were coming to the war. The Natziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, points out that the text should read those who were coming from the war. After all, the war was over at that point. We need to short it down. So right. I will say that even when we are very much successful, we must be very carefully, because we must put the success in a certain perspective.
Just as the language.
Exactly. In order to avoid many of the problems we encounter and their aftermath. Success is important, but it can be dangerous if not viewed in the proper light. And Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
And we
yes.
put this portion in our website.
Yes, we will. And this is Israel is Real. I'm Rachel, and this is
Sonia.
Our theme song is by myself, rachelmusic.com or rachelmusic.net. This is called Hinei Matov. We are on the air every Friday from 10 to 11 in the morning. This is WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk.
Hinei Matov, Umanaim, Shevet Atim.